right whale bore. The captain called all hands and swore he'd take that whale in tow. Soon may the wellerman come to bring us sugar and tea and rum. One day when the tonguing is done, we'll take our leave and go. Da 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 da. Hit the water, the whale sail came up and caught her. Hands to the side, harping and fought her when she dived down low.
Okay, no particular connection with James Cook there. That's just sailors' music from later, in fact, because it was about whaling. And in fact, the most famous type of naval music, of sailors' music, is the sea shanty. But that was really more a 19th century thing. So Cook's crew. And now I'm sure Cook's that music was extremely important for Cook's crew, as it is to all people who are. Isolated in small groups, so we know that the crew took some musical instruments out there. You know, they took some musical instruments with them, but we don't know much about the actual music that they played. Of course, okay. So welcome everybody, and thank you to those of you who put your cameras on. It's nice to have a couple of people to remind me that you guys exist. So, what am I going to do today? Thank you, Isabel. What am I going to do today? Well, I'm hoping that you're all okay and a little bit more Cook. And so we're going to look at something slightly different today, if I can make this happen. Diaporama. This has been transferred onto OpenOffice from my other computer, and so it might work. So I'm going to look at historiography and biography. Most of the videos that I've put online have been chronologically based. You know, going about the first expedition, then the second, then the third, and each time trying to take some key incidents. I might have chosen others, but I chose these, and to try and show some of the things going on, the links with imperial history, the links with colonial attitudes, the links with the history of science, the links with how Cook saw himself, to the extent that we can understand this, because we mustn't imagine that we can understand an 18th century naval man that well. And some of the writings which have tried to psychoanalyze James Cook, I personally find extremely unconvincing, because we're just so far from his life. Remember, he comes back from his first voyage, and two of his children have died. So he said, oh, well, I better go on a second voyage then. And he comes back to the second voyage. Some other child has died. You know, this is what the 18th century is like. It's really, there are a lot of not fun things going on there. Of course, there are a lot of things not fun going on today, in particular in poorer countries than ours. So historiography and biographies. Let's see, how did explorers... adventures and discoveries and encounters and conquests. How did these get onto paper, and what did they mean when they got onto paper? Well, just the first example I want to go for is going back quite a bit further back, and this is a Hakluyt, a good old Hakluyt, who, as his name suggests, is Italian. No, Dutch. Is Dutch, and he wrote the principal. He wrote these two books. This is long before Cook, of course. Divers Voyages Touching the Discovery of America in 1582. And the Principal Navigations, Voyages, Traffics and Discoveries of the English Nation. Now, although his Dutch origins, he was most interested in England. And indeed, the first book was really about encouraging the English elite to think about colonizing North America, which is something, of course, which happened very slowly. You know, the Pilgrim Fathers, and then you've got the Southern bunch who went off to Jamestown, and everybody was looking for gold, and finally they found fish and furs in the north, and tobacco in the south. But that was almost as good. The fish and furs was big money, and tobacco was very big money, although not good for the slaves. So that was one of the first writings, and this was part of something which touched the imagination of those Europeans who could read, which of course was not most of them. And the way that this would go very often is you get the real book, and then many people would write summaries, which were cheaper and which were changed a bit. You know, the copyright, that wasn't really a thing. Copyright was not really a thing. And so many people got bastardized versions. But to go straight on to our very own 18th century, you get good old Alexander Dalrymple, who actually publishes this after Cook goes off on his first expedition, historical collection of the several voyages, that is to say the different voyages, and discoveries in the South Pacific Ocean, so a very, very specific area, the South Pacific, and Dalrymple is absolutely convinced that he knows that there is a southern continent, etc. And indeed, Dalrymple wanted to be the person who captained the ship. And so he never really liked James Cook very much, because Dalrymple thought he was the right person to captain the ship, and he didn't get the job, largely because the Admiralty said, no, we want a military officer. We don't want some intellectual running the show. Now, once Cook had done his own explorations and been killed in the third expedition, then we really get the beginning of the construction. Oh, look, Kathleen has come back. The beginning of the construction of the myth of Cook, and we'll be looking at that. And in particular, immediately after Cook's death, you've got a series of elegies. I mean, the elegies could be in painting. Here you see Zoffany's place. This is in the early 19th century. This is the death of Captain Cook by Zoffany, one of the most well-known pieces. And the different homages to Cook's life and death. Remember, it's a very good story. Yeah? He comes from a poor family, and he discovers places, he goes to places nobody's ever been, and then he's killed by the locals. It's a great story. You know, it's almost as good as, you know, Princess Diana or something. And so you can imagine that, you know, they've got a great story out of it. And this could be paintings, it could be statues, the whole series of statues, some of which were never actually made, and there's a very well-known one. I think it's called the Apotheosis of Captain Cook, where he appears as some sort of demigod, and some of them get made, some of them don't get made. Or it could be writings, and we have one here. This is a French gentleman then, Pierre-Édouard Limontich, and very short quotation from what he said: "Les voyages de Cook sont la marche d'un dieu qui sème l'immortalité." Yeah. So you can see that, you know, if you thought that the praise of Prince Philip this last week was a little bit exaggerated, it's a long tradition. Here you have James Cook being called "un dieu qui sème l'immortalité." Wow, yeah, and there he was just thinking he was a sailor. And you can see that this is published in 1792, so just a few years after Cook's death, and of course in France during the Revolution. So it all gets mixed up with Cook as a symbol of. Of course, it's not necessarily closely linked to Cook at all. That Cook is a symbol of the Enlightenment, the attitude that says, yes, let's go out and conquer the world and conquer the universe with our science, and conquer the world with our trade. This is the rising bourgeoisie, who will also sort out do the French Revolution and so on and so forth. But there's all the idea of, you know, we're going somewhere, and Cook is one of the representatives, because why was he captain? He was not captain because he was an aristocrat. No, he came from a simple background. He worked hard. This is the new, you know, the meritocratic idea is the new idea. You know, the old idea is the feudal idea, you know, before the French Revolution, where you're born into a position in society and that's where you stay because that's what God wants, and so tough. And then afterwards, the bourgeois society, capitalist society, will be about, no, it's not like that. It's like, you know, every individual, the individual is the most important thing, and they go up. And certainly, if you read Le Monte, it's all about how he brings civilization, and naturally, you know, the people are supposed to be grateful. There's another example, just a couple of examples. There's another example. It's very, very interesting, and this is Hannah Moore. She was an English intellectual or a bit later, not later, at the time, and she was one of the people. Now, most at the beginning, most of the people who organised in Britain against slavery were men, because it was so much easier for men to do anything, you know, to organise meetings and so on. But there were rapidly women involved, and Hannah Moore was one of these intellectuals, one of the first blue stockings who organised against slavery, hated slavery. And when she wanted to denounce the slavers and say how awful they were, taking people from their country and treating them extremely badly, and she uses this in one of her expressions. She says, "Oh, it's so sad that the slave traders didn't have the attitude that James Cook had. So this is slightly old-fashioned English, of course. Had these slave traders possessed, O Cook, thy gentle mind, thy love of arts, thy love of humankind, had these slave traders pursued thy mild and liberal plan, discoverers had not been accursed a man, discoverers would not have been." And this is all accursed a man. So you can see that he's become a symbol which is not closely linked to any reality. That's not the point. Certainly, because Cook was a scout and explorer, his job was not to destroy the local societies. That will be later. But you know, so he becomes a possible hero. There were, nevertheless, however, there were some voices at the time. It was never unanimous. Reactions to huge events and people and their exploits are never unanimous. So there were some people in the British elite and the European elite at the time to be unhappy with what was being said. In particular, they didn't like the idea of what had happened at Hawaii. In Hawaii, or as they said at the time, the Sandwich Islands, the general story told about Hawaii, which is probably a bit more complicated than that, but the general story told is that Cook arrived and they treated him as if he was a god. And it's been suggested that the locals, because of course they had no idea where this incredible ship was coming from, and they may well have believed that their own prayers and their own ceremonies had made this phenomenon appear, and that it was a representative of one of their gods. And Cook said, "Oh yeah, okay, God, fine, yeah, I'll do that. Yeah, what's not to like? You know, who wouldn't? I would." But when this all came back to Europe and Britain, of course, the very Christian elite was somewhat, "That's blasphemous. That's blasphemous and heretical and pagan. Cook was very wrong to allow them to think that he was God. He should have told them there is one true God," etc. Yeah, I mean, and this is not an extreme opinion at the time. Now, Cook's myth of a heroic martyr was reinforced in 1784 when the publication of the Third Journal. Cook's, not the one you've seen, but an adapted version written by Douglas, Dr. John Douglas, Canon of St. Paul's, Canon of St. Paul's Cathedral. Yeah, so I've no idea why he was famous, but if you're Canon of St. Paul's Cathedral, you know, it's something to write home about. And he was, after Hawkesworth's version of the First Journal had been very popular but very controversial, and it has been suggested, and we'll come back to this in a later class, it has been suggested that he lost his mental health because of the attacks made upon him. Yeah, and so John Douglas is a little bit more moderate about how he deals with it. John Douglas will publish a version of the journal of Cook, and he will add the journal of the surgeon of the third voyage, William Anderson, and the journal of James King. James King becomes captain once Cook dies, and then the next captain dies, then King becomes the captain. And also, there were also unofficial accounts of the voyage which were produced. John Rickman produced one. And Johann Reinhold Forster, the scientist, produced also a so there were plenty of them. So there were plenty, and this was all, you know, building up, you know, Cook as this sad story, but which represented that attitude that means that the British deserve to dominate the world because he was brave, which is probably true. I mean, these were places where, really, it's very surprising they didn't all drown. The normal thing to happen would be that they all drowned, and they didn't. So, you know, you just have a certain amount of bravery. Now, I just have one example here of one of the alternative voices. And the general tone is Cook is a hero, but I just have one example of one of the more negative versions. The history of the Sandwich Islands, so written in the 1840s. By Sheldon Dibble. Now, Sheldon Dibble knew a lot more about Hawaiian society than Cook did, because he stayed for a long time and he learnt the language. And of course, he was a missionary. And indeed, in most places, if you look at the history of languages, the first dictionaries of languages which do not have a written form are almost always written by missionaries. Because they were the ones that, yeah, we've got to learn their language and write it down because we need to bring them the gospel. Now, today, most of us are less religious and we think, oh, well, you know, is it that important, really? But certainly this was the motivation which led to saving many, many, many languages around the world and finding them in written form. In any case, Sheldon Dibble, who was born in 1809, was a missionary to Hawaii, became a teacher. And he thought that it was strange that the students were learning the history of Britain and they weren't learning the history of Hawaii, the history of the Sandwich Islands. And so he organised a group of students to go around interviewing the old people, a very modern guy really, yeah, and writing down, guided by a questionnaire, and writing down the history of the Sandwich Islands. He then toured the United States giving lectures on Hawaiian history, and the first edition of his book was published, you know, 10 years after he started, in the 1840s. And he in particular did criticize Cook. When he went on shore, this is Dibble writing about Cook, most of the people fled for fear of him, and others bowed down before him with solemn reverence. He was conducted to the house of the gods and into the sacred enclosure and received there the highest homage. In view of this fact and of the death of Captain Cook, which speedily ensued, who can fail being admonished to give to God at all times and even among barbarous tribes the glory which is his due? You can see that in Dibble's opinion, James Cook was killed because he had blasphemed. He had presented himself as a god, so of course the real god was really pretty angry with him, and a few weeks later, sorted Cook out. Yes, that's the opinion. Captain Cook might have, said Eddie, should have, Captain Cook might have directed the rude and ignorant natives to the great Jehovah, instead of receiving divine homage himself. If he had done so, it would have been less painful to contemplate his death, you know, that when James Cook was dying, he must have known, according to Dibble, that he had committed a terrible sin. On your list of terrible sins, saying that you are God is, you know, don't do it. So, some dissenting voices, at the same time, as an official praise for this great hero. I'm going to continue now, really, with six or seven key biographies. There have been 100 biographies of Cook. But that, I want to show you the main ones through the years up to today, which says. Now, I've already mentioned that Cook could be presented as at least four different types of hero. First of all, the hero of the British Empire, who took possession of Australia and of New Zealand for the glory of the greatest civilization ever known. That's not my opinion, I'm quoting somebody. Secondly, Cook could have been seen as the hero of the Enlightenment, advancing through curiosity and science, and not through brigandry and massacre. And indeed, when I finish my videos on the first and the second and the third expedition, I'm going to do a video on Cook and science Because science was big and important and interesting there. Number three, the third kind of hero, he could be the national myth of Australia. Arising from humble beginnings, not afraid of hard work or suffering, down to earth, manly and brave, like all Australians are. And number four, or not, number four is a 21st century hero, that he could be seen as the disruptive entrepreneur. Remember the inventor of Facebook, huh? Who didn't follow other people's ideas and became very rich because of it. This idea that even the name of his ship, Endeavour, says onward and upward, and so on. So those are some of the ways which Cook has been considered a hero. And for most of these hero types, he had two really good cards. First of all, coming from a poor background, and number two, dying in harness, dying at work. Now, I come from a poor background, so I only need to die in work, and I've got to be a hero. That's great. That's cool. No, don't get any ideas. But let's have a look at these biographies then. Let's look at a few particularly prominent lives among the most cited biographical reference materials. The first of these is 1788. 1788. This is obviously a later edition, yes, but 1788, Andrew Kippis, The Life of Captain James Cook. Appearing almost 10 years after his death in Hawaii. I will come back to each one. I'm going to give you the list and then come back to them. The second one is 1836, George Young, Life and Voyages of James Cook, drawn up from his journals and other documents and comprising much original information. They knew how to write titles in those days. The third one, which for the 20th century was extremely popular, I mean, many people when I was young had read this one, Arthur Kitson. This is 1907. Captain James Cook, RN, FRS, The Circumnavigator. Captain, it's given a different title there, but it's interesting. Captain James Cook, RN, FRS. RN, Royal Navy. Yeah, so let's remember, he was a military man. FRS, Fellow of the Royal Society. Because Cook's observations on the transit of Venus and his work, his opinions and his experience in avoiding the disease of scurvy meant that he was adopted into the Royal Society, the scientific, l'Académie des Sciences, à l'Anglaise, the Royal Society. So he was actually, he was really a bit of a scientist, and he didn't just get it because they liked him. No doubt the most influential one was Beagle Hall. Oh, so that's the Kitson. That's the Kitson one, I think. Oh, no, that's it. That's the... je sais plus lequel c'est. Oui, that's the one. Is that... That's Beagle Hall, I think. I think that's Beagle Hall. I'm not sure of my picture anymore. What? It's not very clearly written there. Anyway, the next one is John Court Beagle Hall's The Life of Captain James Cook. And it is thanks to... Or it is the fault of Beagle Hall that you are studying Cook's journal, because he was the one who said, "Hey, the only version we have of Cook's journal is 1,200 pages, and there are different versions of each bit, because remember it was copied, and sometimes they made a mistake or missed something out, and so on." And Beagle Hall was the one who said, "Hey, Cook is so important; we want to get a good." Copy of his versions, and he produced the definitive copy of which you have read a reduced version in the Penguin edition. Somebody just got lost, and so let me make sure I can get them back if necessary. Yes, okay. Oh dear! I just did something I didn't want to do. Can you still see what you could see before? Yeah, okay. So Beagle Hall wrote, as well as producing the journals, editing the journals, he also wrote a 760-page book, The Life of Captain James Cook, I'm sure you've all read it. In fact, you probably learned it by heart. And he is today regarded as having been one of the most authoritative contemporary Cook scholars. And we're also going to look at some later ones, which I'll be speaking about in a moment. This one and this one, Thomas. So let me go back and see what I have to say about each one. So first of all, Kippis. Well, Cook's death in 1779 obviously would consolidate the celebrity effect which had been ongoing since the publication of the first and particularly the second account. The first account was published by Hawkesworth and very much improved in the sense that it was much more exciting to read, but it was not so worried about precise accuracy. That is to say that Hawkesworth got together James Cook's journal and Joseph Banks' journal and mixed them all together, and but wrote the whole thing in the first person. So many of the things which in Hawkesworth says, I then did this, I then did that, and I think that, and that the narrator is Cook, but in fact he just put things in which Cook never said and never did, but Banks did. Yeah, so he made a story. Now, Cinderbund, yeah, this reminds me of when people make films today, and then somebody says, oh, no, but there is an inaccuracy in the film. Yeah, he moved to Manchester in 1963 and not 1964. Whereas, in fact, you know, if you're going to make a film and you're going to summarise somebody's life in 2 hours, then it's a good idea to make changes. And this was Hawkesworth's attitude, that he wasn't trying to. Well, the academic standards we have today didn't exist anyway. And so he was just making sure people would want to read it. So, Cook's death in 1779 would consolidate the celebrity effect. And indeed, the Royal Society, the scientific group, struck a commemorative medal of James Cook in 1780. So immediately they heard of his death. And on it was written, Cook, Oceani Investigator, Acerrimus. James Cook, the most intrepid investigator of the oceans, you will have understood, of course. And on the other side of the commemorative medals, there was a slogan, Nil intentatum nostri liquele. Our men have left nothing unattempted. Now, I don't know this slogan, but it's probably from Virgil or from some Latin writer. That's the way you do these things, yeah. You don't make it up. So he was a hero made, if you like. Now, it's true that this commemorative medal did not sell a million. In fact, it didn't sell a lot. It was not supposed to. It was made for a small number of intellectuals. Nevertheless, little by little, as Julien Demercq, just a writer of the time, says, Cook's death gripped the imagination of writers, poets and artists who saw in the account of the voyage and in Cook's tremendous achievements the value of the Enlightenment. Cook's heroic reputation came to be interpreted and produced in the light of the artist's own ideology, leading to works which not only sought to document, but also to write history. And this played a central role in the mythologizing of Cook's death. I should just say at this point that a lot of what I'm saying about these biographies is taken from the work of my colleague and friend Sanjay Patel from the Université de Clermont-Ferrand. So yeah, I'm copying half of it from her. So, you know, don't worry about it. Teachers are allowed to, it's students who are not allowed to. So that was the context which was around when Kippis published his very first biography of Cook, The Life of Captain James Cook, in 1788. It was immediately translated into French. This is not without importance, yeah? It costs a lot of money to translate books, and of course there's no mass market like today. And so it's very interesting. It was a sign of the interest in French circles, not just for Cook, but for exploring the world. Remember, the French had gone to 60 years earlier. They'd gone to the North Pole and to the equator to work out what the shape of the world was. Some people thought it was like a melon. Yeah, more pointed at the top and the bottom. Everybody knew it was roundish. But some people thought it was more pointed at the top and the bottom, and some people thought it was flatter at the top and the bottom. That's the truth, it's flatter, okay? Spoiler. And the French sent voyages out to find this out, and they discovered that, I think if I remember correctly, Isaac Newton was wrong, and somebody else was right, and it is flatter at the top and the bottom. So this is just a sign, you know, people were excited about discovering the world, and astronomy was a big deal. Discovering comets and so on. There was a Caroline Herschel is one of the women scientists at the time, and she discovered more comets than anybody. She was the great comet discoverer, and with along with her husband, I think she discovered a planet which I think was Uranus. So you know, like discovering the world, this was a big deal. This is what people like to do. Now these are, you know, mostly not professionals, mostly not even in the universities. The great scientific societies of the 18th century are not in the universities. It's not in Oxford, Cambridge, London. It's around Bristol and Birmingham in Britain where you get these scientific societies, and Edinburgh, where they're partly linked with industry like James Watt's, and partly linked with literature like Samuel Johnson and so on. Yeah, this is the Enlightenment. It's not really a thing, but it's a kind of atmosphere. And so that would help Kippis's biography be translated immediately into French in 1789. Good year. And in the dedication, Cook is described as an illustrious source of enlightenment in whose reflected glory the king may bask. It's an interesting idea, is that he's moving forward civilization and the Enlightenment, and this will bring glory to the king. So you have both the modern idea of advancing knowledge and the traditional idea of course, why are you doing this? I'm doing it for the glory of my king, like, you know, as we all are. And so Kippis, on the one hand, is very keen to present Cook is a hero, and on the other hand is also very keen to present his book as authentic. This is real, authentic material. So that's what Kippis was also very interested in, then presenting this as real and authentic. And there's a lot of letters and testimonials from famous people saying how wonderful Cook was. I shouldn't have run down, should I? So let's move on to Young in 1836. Now, after Kippis, there were a great many abridged reprints and translations of Kippis. And there were several other biographies of Cook which were published. But the most influential one after Kippis was George Young's. 466 pages. Life and Voyages of James Cook, drawn up from his journals and other documents. And this would be a typical... So this is 1836, so this is quite a long time afterwards, 50 years later. But this is the time the first fleet has gone to America... Australia. The first fleet has gone to Australia. Britain has decided that New Zealand should be a British colony. They are organising a treaty with the Maori. So obviously Cook is still in the national consciousness, because the great new additions, which are modest for the moment, remember, Australia is just a few penal colonies, but the idea of colonisation is on the rise, and this is a time when you can already get free land in New Zealand if you're British and white. Actually, you probably could if you were British or black, but there are very, very, very few British black people. So the colonisation is big, and so Cook is obviously still in the national consciousness. And also, writing hero biographies about Royal Navy captains was a 19th century thing. Yeah, there were lots of them. This is also later on in the Victorian era, the very well-known moralist and writer Samuel Smiles, who was a bestseller after the Bible. Number two was the Biographies of Heroes by Samuel Smiles. And he would take engineers and naval captains and so on who came from poor backgrounds and present them as this new hero. So here we have Young presented as a hero. And so 50 years after the captain's death, Cook has become a historical figure, a confirmed hero. But also it will give you much entertainment. You have these are exciting adventures, the exciting adventures of. As we move into the 20th century, the beginning of the 20th century, we get Arthur Kitson's 632 pages. Yes, okay, so they're all keen on having quite... You see, really, the Penguin edition of the journals was not so bad. Now, if you examine the British Library and the National Maritime Museum catalogues, in the 19th century, 13 biographies were written. 13 biographies. This is just one of them. So there's the 19th century, now the 20th century, this is the most influential one. Interestingly enough, you can find somebody reading the entire thing on YouTube. So 128 years after Cook's death, when, interestingly enough, the centenary, 1879, the centenary of Cook's death, did not attract much attention in Britain. Indeed, what's interesting today is that the 250th anniversary of Cook's expeditions appears to be attracting more attention than the 200th anniversary. This is partly because of the very important changes in Maori politics and Aboriginal politics in the last 30 years. There's been a real step there. I mean, for the 200th anniversary, the political slogan in Australia always was, always will be Aboriginal land. What an extreme radical, a few radicals. And today, it's a left-wing slogan. But it's a fairly regular slogan. And as you may have noticed, if you go on to university websites from Australia, they will normally say, our university is built on land which belongs to such and such an Aboriginal tribe. So if we go back to Kitson, he never uses the word hero. He never uses the word hero. But he does confirm him as a man of history. It's in the tradition of we read their lives and we learn about the values of determination and so on and so forth. One of the interesting things about Kitson's piece is that he includes for the first time what he calls native accounts of first contacts on the first voyage. Well, not quite the first time, because of course Dibley spoke of them, but in the first time in a biography of Cook. That is to say that Kitson includes some information from oral history from the Maori and the Aboriginals to talk about what their experience of Cook's arrival was. Now, Kitson does not present these views, these experiences, as challenging the official... He includes them for interest, but the master narrative of heroisation remains in place. Nevertheless, it does suggest that there can be different ways of looking at the encounter. Now, Beagle Hole is much more of a university person. By 1970, you see, the idea of university biographies is much more recent. It's a 1940s, 1950s idea. You know, the sort of thing we try to get you to do, footnotes, everything is referenced and so on. Which was not a tradition before. And indeed, Beagle Hole then is the first properly academic piece. And in fact, it was published by his son, because he died on the way, Beaglehole gives a list of the qualities of Cook, and he extremely positive hero. This is what Beaglehole says: genius of whatever sort takes us unawares, is not even in retrospect deducible. We can ponder if we choose over the unlikely origins in place and circumstance of a maritime distinction so extraordinary. And so he's sustained there that, you know, why did Cook do these supposedly wonderful things? We don't know. It's a mystery. It's one of these mysteries of destiny. It is only then, a little later, in the 1970s, that you get really a challenge of this story of Cook, where instead of asking the question, why did Cook become such a genius and a hero? Historians began asking the question, why are we saying he's a hero, and why are we saying he's a genius, and what happened, and what was the effect? And one of the and this has become, in a most general sense, and of course Cook is not the only example, has become part of a tradition of post-colonial, decolonial, or anti-colonial history, where the taking over by the British of Australia, New Zealand, by the Americans eventually of Hawaii, and so on, is seen as a problem and not as a wonderful advance of civilization. Now, the reason this happens is quite obvious in a way. In the 1960s, well, in 1947, India becomes independent. And in the 1960s and 70s, one after the other, African countries become independent. And so the whole idea that the ideal future for humankind is for the big continents to be dominated by European countries no longer feels normal or natural. And so that's one thing. And on the other hand, the universes are much bigger. For every one historian in 1920, there are probably 50 historians in 1970. All the universities become much, much bigger for other reasons, because modern technology requires far more university education. But the fact that there are so many more historians, it means that there's much more variety of voices. And so people begin to look at the South Pacific in this way. And Alan Moore, this is just one example. The fatal impact, the invasion of the South Pacific, 1767, you know, just before Cook, to 1840. When I think the treaty was signed in New Zealand, so very much a negative view. This will cause a row or a debate or both, which will last 50, 60 years. Yeah, which is still going on today. And indeed, the commemorations in Australia and New Zealand, but also in Britain, are just full of this, trying to deal with this question that, on the one hand. But on the other hand, and within this, then there was the publication in 1978 of Edward Said's very well-known book, Orientalism, which basically says European people look at the rest of the world and don't understand much. That's just the version in one sentence. And this will lead to a whole series of debates, in particular the debate between Marshall Salins and Gananath Obeyesekere, which is about European myths of what happened, what happens elsewhere. And in particular, they have a big debate about, they're anthropologists more than historians, they have a big debate about the death of Cook, and what did the Hawaiian people really think about Cook. And they put them together. They argue about this in different ways. It's not very, very clear, but certainly the whole situation has changed. And instead of the First Nations, Maoris or Aboriginals or whoever, instead of them simply being witnesses to history, which Cook made, or victims to history, which Cook made, they become, in the vision of historians, participants in the historical process. Obeyesekere, the second person I mentioned, insisted that indigenous people think in just the same way as Westerners do. And he was very worried that a lot of the accounts of James Cook's death present the, even when they don't do it deliberately, they present the local people as irrational and uncivilized. Whereas Marshall Salins said, no, no, no. It may be that each culture has a different kind of rationality. Okay, so this is the argument, yeah? Are there different kinds of rationality? Now, this is not a directly argument of the racists against the anti-racists, but it opened up all this area. So here we have Nicholas Thomas's 2003 book, The Extraordinary Voyages of Captain Cook. And what is interesting to see is on the front page where previously on the front page we would have Cook with his globe or Cook with his astrolabe, with his technical instruments. Perhaps Cook wearing a sword, never Cook with his musket. Yeah, not the right image. Yeah. But in this we can see the world has changed, because here you have Cook. And look who's on the front page. It's not Cook at all. It's the local peoples. And so this is very important, of course, that when you look at this book, you say, here is a biography of Cook, which thinks that the local peoples are very important. As you can see from the front page. Indeed, this is one of the drawings by William Hodges. Is that in the third voyage, I'm pretty sure. Two warboats from the island of Tahiti. So Cook is being moved away from the centre. And indeed, Thomas even criticises the propensity to idealise Cook. And so Thomas actually says, unfortunately, people tend to idealise Cook. Nevertheless, like Beaglehole, Thomas pays tribute to Cook's character throughout the biography, taking up first and foremost Beaglehole's idea of extraordinary in there. So that's the 2003 biography. What we are seeing is that very slowly it becomes more difficult to defend a traditional hero story. There are still elements of, even today you will see, you know, in some newspapers and so on, and in some museums, elements of the hero story. But it's not so easy anymore, because there are more and more people saying, what was the effect on local people? And was colonialism such a wonderful thing after all? And this includes now writers from the ex-colonies, of course. Another one here. This is the. I don't know why these are in disorder, but here is the medal I spoke of earlier, the Royal Society medal. Here's another example of a recent biography. So it's before the Thomas one. This is Richard Howe, and he has a particular example as well. In fact, all biographies are changing, especially all academic biographies are changing. And what Howe decides to do is to concentrate on the day-to-day experience of being an officer or an ordinary sailor or one of the scientific passengers on these bold and dangerous voyages. You remember, they are cooped up in a ship 100 feet long, 28 feet wide. And there's 105 people on the ship. They're absolutely tiny, especially the sailors. Joseph Banks has the big cabin. It's not big, it's tiny, but he has a real bed. James Cook, the officers have smaller cabins, but nevertheless they have a hammock with some sort of mattress. And then the soldiers, if you imagine a very small bedroom that you might have your little bro, but the smallest bedroom in your house, you have to put, there would be 10 adults in there. Just on hammocks, side to side, yeah. It really is impressively small. I think I mentioned, I went to see the replica. You think, oh my God, you know, impossible. And of course, what you find out in Howe is a lot about the experience of life. some of the crew were drunk in the morning and at lunchtime and at night. This was not surprising. And indeed, Cook mentions at one point, he mentions one of the people dying of drinking so much that they just died. And when Cook mentions this in his journal, he doesn't seem to be surprised. You know, this is just how, well, you know, sometimes people drink so much that they die. Yeah? And so, you know, that's that kind of thing. Now, when Howe does this, this is not so surprising, because over the last 50 years, there has been an increasing... I've just turned everything down. There's been an increasing interest in experience. If you go to museums, or if you read history, the rise of the importance of individual of ordinary people's experience is absolutely the most important thing that's happened to history in the last 50 years. I went to the exhibition on the First World War in London. And they changed the, because of the centenary, they changed the exhibition. And the one thing that they changed mostly is, what was it like for the ordinary people? That was the new centre of history, whereas previously that was not considered important at all. Howe also talks about the scientific motifs, and he works very hard at trying to imagine what the experience was of both Cook and the locals when they met each other. In particular, he goes into great detail about the diversity of local peoples. One of the difficulties of the colonial view is it tends to see non-Christian, non-white groups as all the same, whereas in fact from Tahiti to New Zealand, to Australia, to the Friendly Islands, to Tonga, these civilizations were completely different. Even from the point of view of technology, some of the peoples they met, had very few clothes or tools, whereas others had quite sophisticated ones. Just another couple of examples of writings about Cook. You have another approach, Peter Moore, Endeavour, The Ship and the Attitude That Changed the World. And what they're doing here is changing the focus a little bit. Let's write the biography of the ship and not of Cook. Now, this has an advantage in that it avoids the question of, was James Cook a hero, or was James Cook village a villain? And this historian said, "Well, you know, let's not focus on that." Now, it's very difficult to do. It's very difficult to avoid, because even if you think that that's the wrong question, like I do, in fact, you know, if somebody interviews you about the anniversary of Cook's expeditions, you can be sure that when they write it for the newspaper, the headline will be "Cook, villain or hero." Because that's, you know, that's what makes a good journalistic newspaper. And so this is one way of looking at it. And indeed, another example of this is that when the Musée du Quai Branly did an exhibition which had a lot of items in it collected by Cook, they chose not to put Cook in the title. And the title of the exhibition was just Oceania. Now, they probably lost some visitors because of that. Because the advantage of putting Cook in the title is a lot of people know who he is, or you find him on Wikipedia, and it's a focus, and it's a specific focus of people like that. Meanwhile, this is a children's book for the 21st century, Captain Cook. So you can see that we're still in there, and I bought this recently. You still get the hero story. It's still a hero story. Very much so. Quite interestingly enough, it tries to present some of the ways in which local peoples were mistreated as the fault of somebody else and not James Cook. In particular, it says the king made him take goats and carrots and turnips to help the locals with their agriculture. And this book says Cook didn't agree with this, but he was obliged to do it. This is complete nonsense. It's completely invented, yeah. So there is still work being done at protecting the Cook myth. And there's plenty more. And there's plenty more here. Captain Cook, Master of the Seas. Captain Cook and the Search for Antarctica. Cook, Captain Cook. What is it? Civilization and Betrayal. Obsession and Betrayal in the New World. Captain Cook rediscovered. Whoa. So you have a choice, but none of them is quite as simple as it used to be. And this is an interesting children's one. You wouldn't want to explore with Captain Cook. And this is one of a series which explains to children just how terribly hard life was in some of the famous points of history in the past. Finally, what do they do when they need to or want to commemorate or celebrate the arrival of Cook here and there? Because it's the 250th anniversary of the expeditions. Well, it's very difficult. First of all, when Cook arrived, are we celebrating that? Because it was a wonderful thing. On the other hand, Aboriginal peoples could quite reasonably say, oh, well, then we don't really want to celebrate it. Let's commemorate it, because it was terrible. And one of the very key suggestions, I am not saying that it works. In fact, personally, I think it's very problematic, is this expression, shared history. Cooktown is a town in Australia named after good old James Cook, of course. Yes, I did. Je vois que vous suivez ça bien. And here is this is Endeavour 250. It's the 250th anniversary, and this is the main page, Cooktown's shared history. Yeah. Now, 50 years ago, when it was the 200th anniversary, they didn't worry about that. So, the wonderful Cook who came and brought civilization. I'm exaggerating a little. And so shared history is the proposal, which is very interesting and very controversial and very complex, but that's one of the things that's going on now. And here's another example. This is from Canberra, the capital of Australia. And they produced, again, the landmark Endeavour Anniversary Exhibition. Now notice again, we're not putting Cook at the centre, we're putting Endeavour at the centre. And look at the title of the exhibition, in a landmark expedition showcasing one of the great seafaring feats of our time. So we're saying good things about Cook. But look at the title, Endeavour Voyage, the untold stories of Cook and the first Australian. So you have these first Australians are doing something. This exhibition immerses visitors in the moment when two great knowledge systems came to face. Immerses visitors. We're going to tell you about the experience of the people. As the first Australians encountered James Cook and his crew. Endeavour Voyage, the exhibition, goes to the heart of Australia's shared history, shining a light on the country's often tumultuous past and exploring the possibilities for the future. Okay, shared history, tumultuous past, possibilities for the future. I think that, you know, there are many, many debates about this, and it doesn't, you know, everybody's entitled to their own opinion. I would say, though, that it is, as you say in French, c'est vite dit. Histoire partagée, c'est vite dit. And in a situation where today racism against Aboriginals is still very, very strong, that makes it a little bit more difficult to make shared history such a real thing. And here you have the exhibition. This is a writing writing about the stories of Aboriginal miners. Shared history forgotten. Yeah, so this writer, this university person, is being a little sceptical. So, you know, they're talking all about shared history. Well, nobody ever talks about this history. You know, that's the kind of thing. And that was extremely well timed, because I just got to it through my hour. But I do have time for you to ask questions, if you have questions that you would like to ask. So we have a little chat place there. So if anybody does have a question, you may naturally put it into the chat now. Let me